Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
I remember the first day I saw him. Very tall, very thin, with grey, close-cropped hair, and dressed all in black except for the round white collar at his neck. I was on my swing, which hung from the bough of a stout tree in our garden. He walked towards me, slightly stooped, but at the same time with a spring in his step. My mother always made him cocoa. Every summer, William Stevenson came down from Dublin for 2 weeks' holidays and stayed in a guest house beside the church. He had grown up in the house we then lived in, from where his father, the county doctor, had practiced medicine. He was drawn back here to the families he still knew who lived dotted around the county, and to whose houses my father drove him on his annual visits. In later years, I took over the job as driver. Father Stevenson taught us Switch, a card game which he would play for hours, delighting in its unpredictability. He practiced breathing exercises to maintain and improve his constitution, which involved taking a very deep breath and holding it while saying, "Well, ma'am, is the dinner ready?" From him I first heard the phrase, "Every mickle makes a muckle." His jacket was often threadbare, but he shone with such an inner conviction that was all anyone noticed. In primary school, he told me, one cold winter's day in class, he had neglected to remove his cap. The master remonstrated with him, to which he responded, "I'll wear a taller hat than you one day." At 16 years of age, he decided to join the Jesuits. His father was sad, but also elated that his son would become a priest. On the day before he left home, his father brought him for a jaunt in the pony and trap around Knockaderry, the local reservoir, a lake of about 80 acres. It was an Indian summer, and they had brought a picnic, which they laid out on the slopes of the lakeside. When the picnic was finished, he walked on his own down to the lake shore. He stood there, realizing the moment, and skimmed flat stones over the water. At last he headed back uphill to where his father was waiting. On the way he passed a tiny knee-high holly sapling and, on an impulse, tugged it by its roots out of the earth. "Something to remember the day," he said when they got back into the trap. His father laughed at the forlorn plant and told him it would never grow. The next day William left home for the last time. That was in September 1898. Over the course of his training, William would study in Jesuit houses in Tullabeg, County Offaly, and in Jersey and the Channel Islands, where he was in the same class as Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, the famous philosopher. "De Chardin was a great man for collecting fossils," he told me during one of our forays into the countryside. "He'd never come back to the house without a pocketful of stones." In 1926, Teilhard de Chardin would become famous for his part in the excavations in Zhukujian, China, southwest of today's Beijing, which led to the discovery of Peking man, a link in the evolution of the human species dating back at least 350,000 years. William Stevenson spent 6 years in Sydney, Australia, from 1905, where he was a noted rower. Sydney, he remembered, as little more than a shanty town. Back in Ireland, he was ordained in 1914 and spent most of the following decades in parish ministry, mostly in County Galway. Over the course of his long life, he would live to be 98, he wrote books which contained simple reflections and prayerful meditations. The Child of Mary prayer book, which he edited and was published by the Irish Messenger Office, went into 40 editions. His heart never left his childhood home, and it was the knowledge that we had both grown up in the same house, had swum in the same sea and heard the same seagulls, that bound us together. His final years were spent in the Jesuit house in Rathfarnham Castle. I went to see him there and brought my wife and our firstborn child to introduce them to my old friend. We went up a rickety back stairs and into his little room with his fireplace, his desk, on which his work in progress was scattered, and his narrow bed. He was as bright and engaged that day as I ever remembered him. He spoke again about his growing up by the sea and cautioned against swimming more than twice a day, which he claimed was lowering. He described his travels around the world and the people he had met. With a nod in my direction, he said, "When I saw this young fellow for the first time, he was in the garden of my old house, on his swing." "You know you need a good, strong tree for a swing," he continued, "like the tree his swing was tied to." His eyes twinkled. "It was a holly tree," he said. "I planted it there myself, one day, a long time ago."
Green groweth the holly, so doth the ivy. The winter blasts blow ne'er so high. Green groweth the holly, gay are the flowers, hedgerows and ploughlands. The days grow longer in the sun. So for the
a robin flits from the hedgerow across our path. Clara, our young Swedish visitor, takes her phone from her pocket and snaps as the bird lifts into the air and flies away. She shows us the photo, a flurry of out-of-focus wings. "It's for my father," she says. "He started watching birds in the garden during lockdown." We don't get robins coming so close, so intimate in Uppsala. Intimate is the word she uses to describe the traditional music session in the Crane pub in Galway, the night before she joined us in Inishbofin. She looks for another word to define the even closer house gathering we bring her to in the cottage beside Murray's bar. The best we can come up with is cosy. Later, she will write the word in her journal. Sitting around the turf fire at the house session, taking turns to sing, recite, or play a tune, she is tickled when Rita takes herself to the toilet to practice her Shan No steps before emerging and, lamenting her inappropriate shoes, begins to hop, twist and shuffle to whistle tunes in the small space in front of the fire, humming away to herself. When it comes to Clara's turn, no one expects this young Swedish woman to contribute. There are calls for ABBA, which she ignores. She tells of the martyred Saint Lucia, the bearer of light in the dark Swedish winters, and Lucia's Day on December 13th. She describes the procession, the girl chosen to take the part of Lucia leading, wearing lighted candles on her head, the girls who follow, singing traditional songs, wearing long white robes and garlands of flowers in their hair. Clara's voice is pure and clear, and there's a hush in the room as the strains of the Swedish folk song lilt in the air. We walk home in the darkness of the unlit lanes, listening to the rasping of the corncrake, which follows our progress past Day's pub, up the hill and on to the East End. "My father would love it here," she says, as we explain the efforts of the islanders to preserve the natural breeding grounds of the near-extinct corncrake. Walking along the beach next morning, we point out the Galway Mountains, the 12 Bens and Mam Turks suddenly emerging from cloud, deep purple on the horizon, the turquoise of the sea. She is amazed by the things we take for granted, animals roaming free on the hills and grazing the fields, cows with their eternal sideways munching and their serious long-lashed eyes, sheep and lambs that sidle up close to curiously examine her before a slight movement sends them leaping away over the ditch, chickens that potter around the farm gates. "Fresh," she writes in her journal when the swimmers describe the water temperature. "Does that mean really cold?" she asks. "It works for weather too," we tell her. She tries it out with a twinkle in her eye. "A fresh day," she says, as we climb the bog road, wind whipping hair into our eyes, clouds racing, shadows mottling the bog pools, the bog cotton flittering in the breeze. And there's a soft day too, we explain, when the rain is a slight drizzle and the wind just a whisper. She settles her black baseball cap over her short blonde hair. Her smile is broad and open, her clothes practical, her travel bag light. She is unadorned apart from 5 silver earrings, one a recent addition, which she twirls as she walks. She is chatty, respectful, engaged but not intrusive, and you wonder about the parents that nurtured her interest in the world during her young life. Maybe you wonder more about the father who features so much in her chatter. The father who spent a wild year sharing a cold, damp house in Galway while in college, who told her that he was grateful for his Swedish Army issue sleeping bag when the winter storms blew in off the Atlantic through the leaky windows. As she steps onto the boat to leave for the mainland, she tells us she will remember that Inishbofinne is the island of the white cow. And as the ferry rounds the pier, she waves with a twist of her erect hand, and we find that we have been strangely moved by the short visit of this 20-year-old Swedish woman, whose journey will now take her back to Galway to stay with her father's friend from a time before she was born, then to Amsterdam and beyond. We wonder what the other hostel dwellers, with their various mother tongues and common English, will make of her new vocabulary. Will they understand, as she spreads her arms wide, that she loved the whole shebang of her time in the west of Ireland, all the soft, fresh days of it?
Jemima and Eliza has a certain ring to it, doesn't it? Echoes of the film Thelma and Louise, perhaps. Jemima Montgomery was born in 1807 into a landowning family in Donegal. She was a cousin of the Anglo-Irish novelist Maria Edgeworth and was evidently proud of that connection, for she went on to name her only son Edgeworth. During a visit to Germany in the 1830s, she met a member of the Bavarian nobility, who went on to become royal chamberlain in the court of 3 Bavarian kings. After the couple were married in 1838, the Donegal woman spent the rest of her life in Bavaria as Baroness von Tautvius, dividing her time between Munich and her husband's castle in the southeastern corner of Germany. During the 1850s and 60s, Jemima published 4 novels in English, all of which were set in Germany. Although admired by Anthony Trollope and Henry James, and widely read in their day, her novels are no classics. Written in the style of the mid-19th century, her prose seems clunky to us, and the plots somewhat rambling and long-winded. The best parts of her novels come when she evokes the Bavarian mountains, a world of hill and dale, forest and rocks, of such wild and fantastic forms. She wrote of the ultramarine blue of the distant heights and the long region of eternal snow and ice beyond, and of the gigantic rock, thundering torrents, dark lakes, and narrow secluded valleys. She comes across as someone who grew deeply fond of her adopted land, whose natural wonder she was inclined to contrast with the industrial squalor of mid-Victorian England. It may be that aspects of rural Bavaria reminded her of her native Donegal. What she wrote reads in parts like a travelogue, and she was credited with encouraging numerous English visitors to explore the Bavarian mountains. Her attitude to Ireland may be inferred from the Irish characters that appear in her novels. One character observes that since coming to Germany, she has found a new appreciation for Ireland and now likes being seen as an Irish woman. Another character states that he never wanted to be referred to as an Englishman again. The O prefix in his surname would no longer be omitted, but would act, as with its French and German equivalents, as proof of descent from what he called decent people. When Jemima von Tautvius died in 1893, the local press praised her masterly descriptions of Bavaria. Her death also attracted an obituary in the New York Times, which said that her novels were still numbered among the most widely read works of fiction, adding that they were always cordially praised by reviewers. Jemima spent 10 years at the court of Bavaria's King Ludwig I, but she was not the only Irish woman moving in that exalted circle. Eliza Gilbert was born in County Limerick in 1820, the daughter of a British soldier and an Irish mother. As a child, she had spent time in India with her parents and was back there as an adult with an officer with whom she had eloped after her mother tried to marry her off to a much older man. She returned to Europe when her marriage lapsed and embarked on a series of affairs with, among others, the composer Franz Liszt and the novelist Alexandre Dumas. By the time she arrived in Munich in the 1840s, she had acquired a new name and considerable notoriety. She had become Lola Montez and was now famed as an exotic dancer. It didn't take her long to catch the eye of King Ludwig, who had her painted as part of the gallery of beauties he commissioned, depicting the world's most beautiful women. Lola's striking image still adorns the walls of Munich's Nymphenburg Palace. Her scandalous affair with the king and his rash decision to make her a countess stirred things up in Munich, and he was forced to abdicate during the revolutionary year of 1848. Lola fled Germany, but continued her adventures in Europe, Australia, and America, where she ended up touring as a celebrity speaker, recounting her daring deeds. She died in New York in 1861 and is buried at the Greenwood Cemetery there. The quieter living Jemima lived more than twice as long as Eliza, dying in her 87th year, thus illustrating perhaps the value to human health of a settled existence. Jemima and Eliza only overlapped in Munich for a couple of years. But as the royal chamberlain's wife and the king's mistress, they must have known each other well. Jemima was said to have lived a retired life, which was a far cry from Lola's experience, and the two probably had little in common. You can't help wondering, though, what they might have made of each other. Did they ever compare notes about their homeland, about Limerick and Donegal? Their encounters in Munich would provide cracking material for an intriguing historical novel. Shall we call it When Jemima Met Lola? Why not?
I have a sheepskin coat from years ago. Tan collar, warm lining, fur-style collar that I had worn over several winters and then put away. Thankfully, I didn't give it away, as I have done with so many other pieces of clothing. I wore the coat again recently, and a girl said to me, "Oh, I love your coat. Is it vintage?" I laughed and said, "It's me that is vintage." And then I wondered, antique or vintage, what is the difference? And where do I fit on the timeline? When I checked, antique is something from before the 1920s. True vintage is 50 years ago. Vintage is 20 years ago, and retro is a garment imitating vintage style. So, the clothes my grandmother wore as a girl are antique. My mother's are true vintage. And I flow from true vintage to vintage, depending on the clothing. There are times when I see an item of clothing in a shop, like a skinny ribbed turtleneck jumper, and it makes me smile. I wore that type of jumper in the 70s. I never would have thought that the same clothes would come back in style. How clothes that are modern and then became old-fashioned would become up-to-date again. We perceived then how we would look after 2001, the Space Odyssey year. Shows like Lost in Space or Star Trek gave the impression that we would be in mercury-coated clothes by now. Looking back, I remember the first time I saw a girl wearing wide bell-bottom trousers with a floral pattern. We were in Central Park, New York, in the 60s. And when I pointed the girl out to my mother, she rolled her eyes and said, "Oh, a hippie." I watched the girl as she walked through the park, the way the end of the bell-bottoms flapped as she moved. It was the age of Aquarius, a time of rising protest against the Vietnam War. The girl's wide bell-bottoms stood out to me in a city of men in suits. For that moment in time, the hippie movement and their clothes were a sign of a peaceful revolution. And there were quiet braveries in the wearing of certain clothing here as well. When I look back at photographs of my mother and aunts from those years, they look so cool, so stylish. In a time when women were still being churched, the first woman in a small town who walked up the aisle and into a pew while wearing a miniskirt showed courage. After a while, many were wearing miniskirts, so there would have been protection in their numbers. But that first woman would have started others chattering, would have risked being called mutton dressed as lamb. Or the first woman who landed at the school gates to collect her children while wearing trousers. The first woman to turn up at a dinner dance wearing a trouser suit or hot pants. Or the immigrants that landed home on vacation wearing the newest styles, like my aunt, as she walked up the town in a brightly patterned dress and wearing sunglasses, would have raised a few eyebrows and comments, "Ah, the returned Yank." Young men also took steps in style braveries, like the first Teddy Boys landing home from London to rural Ireland. Are those boys the first who even slightly followed the glam rock flamboyance of Bowie, Sweet, or Freddie Mercury, and wore the gear to local dance halls? And the first who wore Bay City roller trousers and shirts into their secondary schools? Those who were marched home again to change or else be placed into detention? Their bravery and risking being bullied for standing out. All those clothes are vintage now and can be worn with ease. If I had held on to my going away suit from 1980, it would be wearable now for someone. The skirt and jacket and black and white houndstooth check. But is that idea of a going away suit that is true vintage? The way the security guard at Belfast Airport's departure gate handed me a form to fill out and she said, "Don't forget to use your new name." I asked her how she knew, and she laughed. "I can spot newlyweds a mile off." And she looked at my new suit, shoes and handbag. So many styles that once were new trends are now moving anti-clockwise through time. Miami Vice suits, Starsky cardigans, Dynasty and Dallas shoulder padded jackets might all come back again. Who knew in the 70s, 80s, or even the 90s, that we could be modern then and be stylish all over again, and the same type of clothes. When it comes to fashion, the future can be the past and still bring joy.
Wake up your sleepy head, put on some clothes, shake up your bed, put another log on the fire for me.
There's a mystery in our family concerning my great uncle Thomas. Born in 1888, he was the youngest of seven children. His siblings all emigrated to England or America. But he stayed behind to help his parents with the 30-acre farm in Cully near Charlestown in County Sligo. But to this day, no one knows why the farm wasn't left to him as the only son who stayed behind. Instead, when my great-grandfather died in 1921, it was discovered he'd left the farm to a middle child, my grandfather James, who was also a twin. At the time, James was away working down the pit in Montana, earning good money. Nevertheless, he returned to take up his inheritance. James had been matched when young by a local matchmaker with my grandmother, Kate Gallagher from Kilmavie. I'm named after her. They got married in 1926 in her parish church. But what to do with Thomas? A small farmstead in Clunohill, the next townland, came up for sale, and my grandfather bought it for Thomas for £400. This was a three-room stone cottage, with outbuildings, 20 acres, and some bog. He took his mother, my great-grandmother, to live with him, and every night Thomas lit the clay pipe for her. That's apparently how he came to smoke himself. Great-uncle Thomas had been in the old IRA during the War of Independence, and he received a pension until his death in the 1980s. Thomas never looked much like a freedom fighter to me. He went everywhere sitting sideways on his donkey. As a child, coming home from Nottingham every summer, I couldn't believe I was related to this eccentric old man in his black three-piece suit, with his long hooked nose, who habitually gurgled like a turkey and then spat out frothy phlegm from the right-hand corner of his mouth. My mother insisted we walk over to visit him every other day of our holiday. I remember sitting in a hard chair by his open fire. It was always dark in his cottage and the walls were stained with soot. There was a raggedy red curtain pulled over his outshop bed. The cranes over the fire held the black kettle, and a line of his black wool socks hung drying under the mantelpiece. He would ignore me, but he had great time for my mother. She enjoyed flirting with this old man. Rose Beglin, you'd be in fierce danger if I was a tadine younger, he'd say, and she'd laugh and shoot back. I've tamed wilder stallions than you in my day, Thomas Carty. Now be a good boy and make us the tea. He unhooked the cups off the tan painted dresser. There were always large black leaves floating in the strong tea, thick with creamy milk from his cow. It was pure torture drinking it. Then there'd be a sudden flutter of wings as a hen flew down from the loft above us looking for crumbs. "Shoo her out, won't you, Caitlin?" he'd say. "Shoo her out the door." And I'd get up and do as I was told. One time, Michael, my brother, was with us. Thomas was poking and poking at the fire with a long stick. "Why are you poking so much?" Michael asked him. "I'm hunting for my egg, gossoon." Whereupon a grey, dusty ball fell out of the ashes. He lifted it, then rolled it up and down his thigh. He peeled off the shell, then with his black fingers he ate his hard-baked egg, washing it down with slurps of tea from his white aluminium mug. Thomas came over to my grandparents' house most Sundays for his lunch. The dogs would start barking and I'd run out to watch him clip-clopping down the long driveway on the donkey. He always had a thick stick in his left hand and he tapped the donkey's backside lightly as though he was a jockey. Arriving, he'd slide off slowly, never using a saddle, and there was a thump when he landed on the ground. He handed me the reins and I walked her into the back field of lush grass. One Sunday, Grandma took Thomas into the front bedroom, where she'd had a carpet fitted in place of linoleum. He shook his head in disgust and said, "Jesus, Kate, 'tis a terrible sin to be walking on all that money." When his old cow died, Thomas bought a cow at a bargain price from a local farmer. The following week, he was chatting to a neighbour and she said to him, "You a diddle, Thomas, giving good money for a cow with only three teats." He laughed and spat back at her. "She, you're only jealous, Margaret. Doesn't she have one more than you?" In his very last years, he went to the county home in Sligo. On one visit, I was mortified as I walked along a corridor with him behind a pair of nuns. Didn't he lift one of their black habits with his walking stick and proclaim, "That's a waste of a great arse, Sister Veronica." She giggled girlishly as she turned and pulled her habit down. "Now, Thomas Carty, you are a real terror. You should be ashamed of yourself." My great uncle Thomas died in 1983 at the ripe old age of 96, and he wasn't one bit ashamed of himself. Not one bit.
My nephew explores the world as I watch. He is transfixed by the movements of swans and cygnets on the canal, because at 18 months those sights are new. Yesterday we watched a cob storm across the water, wings flared, hissing and screaming to scare away a rogue drake. For a moment I saw things through my nephew's eyes. As we resumed our journey, I returned to the role of his protector for the afternoon. But my perspective had changed, my senses recalibrated by everyday scenes. I get to live vicariously through his field of vision. He goes to bed for the night at 6:30, and the baby monitor affords glimpses of his world. He shrieks at first, then coos and calms himself for sleep. The bars of the cot imprison his image on the screen, tumbling through slumber. My eyes follow this intrigue while he thrashes about unawares. At times, he can be seen gazing, as if staring at something in the darkness. My sister is accustomed to these pictures by now, but to me, they seem like a magic act. Nothing stirs for an hour, and then he bursts into life, rolling from side to side, tossing his blanket before reappearing upright, his back against the bars. He holds this pose for a moment, then tumbles again, breaking the spell. Watching him walk is still a novelty act for me. He steps confidently through the front door at my parents' house, eager to reach the kitchen. What might appear like hesitation is disguised fascination. He stops only to look up at the faces greeting him. Their giddy expressions and childlike thrills must seem strange to him, but his initial confusion quickly gives way. One by one, he catches the voices of Granny and Grandad. Then he makes for the kitchen. All ground floor presses have been conquered now that he's grown tall enough to grasp each handle. The fridge door is a magnet. Characters from The Simpsons catch his eye. But these are old moves, and he runs through them as if they form part of an elaborate ruse. Every so often, he looks right, a glance that betrays him. The utility room now holds greater appeal. Tumble dryers and washing machines are his latest fascination. He stares into the drum of each appliance, and the glass doors capture his reflection, a version of himself that he doesn't recognise. 1 week, he managed to halt a wash before the end of its cycle. Only when I tried to prise the lock did we realise the door would not budge. This boy has changed our interior worlds. His physical presence brings a new dimension to the life of every house he visits. We move and act and talk with him in mind. Our worries are wiped away when he walks into the room. Each of us tries to comprehend life on his level. Granny forgets her arthritic pain for a while, elated to have him sitting on her knee. He takes pride of place in her lap. All of our aches fade. He commands full attention, and we connect in whatever way. I wait in the hall and whistle to distract him, my face hidden behind the door jamb. He smiles whenever I steal a peek. Instinct remains his ultimate guide, a circular path leading to Mammy. As he passes through a new zone, baby days behind him, he toddles forward. With a fit of giggles, he fills the house, hitting the high notes. But his cries are more pained. He senses change more acutely, especially when his mother leaves the room. His mind is growing along established lines, and he gets upset when they alter. An unhappy child makes each of us unhappy in our own way. So we rush to comfort him, the same way we mimic his laughter, responding to those basic human calls. Arms upstretched, he seeks comfort from his elders. With glee, Grandad obliges. My nephew responds with pure delight, playing games of peekaboo. Most days, he gets great fun from an empty plastic bottle, held aloft like a chalice, each hand grasping the green container. Every so often, he stops to take a sip. Head tilted, he bites into the cap before offering it up. Grandad has a swig and makes a glugging sound. "Oh, laffy, laffy, James," says Granny, all of them happy in cahoots. I look to my nephew, nearing 2, almost at the end of his first cognitive stage. His world is changing, day by day, while my days meld into each other. When he's my age, he will have no memory of how he thrilled his uncle. He can sleep straight through for 12 hours, sometimes stock still, sometimes moving wildly. That was me once upon a time. Was I carefree? Was my sleep as sweet? It doesn't matter. The child I see before me reflects a living surface. He moves now, in this present, deaf to all other tenses. I hear him calling me into his moment.
On this morning's mix of new and recent archive scripts, we heard The Swing by Peter Cunningham, Soft Fresh Days by Helen Lehert, When Jemima Met Lola by Daniel Mulhall, Wearing Vintage by Denise Blake, Great Uncle Thomas by Kate Carty, and Nephew by Brendan Coffey. The music was Green Growth, The Holly by Susan McKeown, Sancta Lucia, sung by the Swedish Nacka Girls Choir, La Suisse Pastorelle by Liszt, played by Yeno Yando, Oh You Pretty Things by David Bowie, and Over the Moon to Peggy's The Dogs Among the Bushes by Oisín MacDiarmida on fiddle and Seamus Begley on accordion. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon, and the producer is Sarah Binchy. You can listen back on the RTE radio app and find more from Miscellany on rte.ie/culture. And sticking with new writing on rte.ie/culture, that's where you can now read all the short stories on this year's Francis McManus competition shortlist. The stories will be broadcast every night starting tomorrow on Late 8 here on RTE Radio 1. They'll also be featured regularly on Arena ahead of a special Arena RTE short story competition event in the Pavilion Theatre Dunleary on the evening of Friday the 29th of November, with music and performances from all the stories before the judges award their top prizes. For tickets, see pavilliontheatre.ie.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.